Thank you. Thank you very much, Chair, ladies and gentlemen, brothers and sisters, for that. I'd like to, if I may, start off with saying what I'm not going to say before I say what I am going to say, if that doesn't sound too Donald Rumsfeld-like. Yeah. The first thing is, I want to make it clear, especially because my name's George, that I have no intention of recolonizing the United States. It's not my intention to lecture you or pretend that we in the anti-war movement in Britain have all the answers, and I tell you in advance, because a lot of people ask me every night, I'm not moving here and taking up politics in the United States. I hate imperialism and colonialism. I come from an Irish... I come from an Irish and Scottish background, so we know a thing or two about imperialism. Once I came home from school and told my Irish grandfather that the teacher had said that the British had an empire so vast that upon it the sun never set. And my grandfather answered, "That's because God would never trust the English in the dark." I never had any cause to doubt him. So I'm definitely not here to recolonize. And neither am I here out of any spirit of anti-Americanism, which is something that is put to me on a daily basis by the newspaper men and radio men who are interviewing me. There were several today. One of them was simply crazed. What was his name? Medved. Did somebody hear it, yeah? It was a masterpiece. I went into the studio, and the whole of his desk, the entire desk, was covered in Israeli website press cuttings about me, as if this were the gospel chiseled in stone and handed down. But he didn't like me telling the audience that. Got terribly upset about that. But call it providence. He got so upset, he spilled a huge cup of coffee all over it. And it was thereafter unreadable. No, I want to make this point seriously. There is absolutely nothing anti-American about me. As a matter of fact, I'll let you in on a secret not many people know. I am the great-grandson of probably the only woman in the entire 19th century who emigrated from America to Scotland. At a time when thousands were sailing in the opposite direction. I think she got on the wrong boat, I must tell you. But that's what she did. And if she hadn't, I wouldn't be here. So there's nothing anti-American in what I intend to say. Neither have I come here to speak against the troops. There was somebody following me around in Wisconsin the other night with a T-shirt saying, "We love the troops." Well, we love the troops too. That's why we want to bring them home before any more of them get killed. Eight more in the last 24 hours. Eight more Americans. I don't know, because I'm away from the news, whether there's any increase in the British death toll as a result of the extraordinary incidents in Basra. I don't know if that's being covered in the American media, where two British soldiers dressed as Arabs, who may have been carrying explosives, which opens up a very interesting potential can of worms. If true, what were they doing with explosives? And where were they going with the explosives? And how many other explosions have been not necessarily carried out by the people we were told they were carried out by? That's you think I'm being paranoid, you haven't read Graham Greene's The Quiet American or seen the movie or know anything about the history of colonialism and provocations and so on. But I don't know if the British death toll has increased, but I do know that nearly 2,000 young American men now lie in the ground as a result of this grotesque blunder, this terrible crime that was committed in Iraq. And I do know, at least I believe, that well over 100,000 Iraqis also lie in the ground. Though when I said that the other day in the debate with Christopher Hitchens, I quoted the Johns Hopkins University and the Lancet, the Journal of the British Medical Association, in their study which showed over 100,000 civilian deaths in Iraq since the invasion, not counting the deaths in Fallujah, which would have skewed their survey, so great was the death toll there. When I said that, Mr. Hitchens said they were crazed fabricators. I was so shocked at that, I asked him to repeat it, and he repeated it. And I was so shocked, I asked if there was really anyone in this audience who believed one of the world's great universities, Johns Hopkins Universities, and one of the most prestigious and respectable medical journals in the world, The Lancet, really were crazed fabricators. And a section of the hall shouted, "Yes, yes, they are crazed fabricators." Well, I tell you this, if I have to choose who to believe, between Johns Hopkins University and The Lancet, or Christopher Hitchens and George W. Bush, I know who I'm believing. I know who I'm believing. So, it's definitely not because we hate the troops. It's the opposite of hating the troops to say they should not be sent to kill or be killed anymore for this terrible crime and this pack of lies that I talk about. After all, how could we hate the troops? Who are the troops? The troops are conscripted by high unemployment, by low wages, by poverty, by racism, by poor prospects, by a sense of despair of making any kind of life for themselves in the civilian society. Recruited in high schools, in your country at least, recruited in universities in both of our countries, recruited in parking lots, recruited down on the mean streets of industrial and post-industrial Britain and the United States, and sent as workers with a gun to kill other workers. These are the troops. And it's because we don't hate the troops that we demand their withdrawal from Iraq and Afghanistan and everywhere else that George Bush and Tony Blair have sent them. And the last thing I'm not here to do is to speak for Al-Qaeda and Osama bin Laden. This lunatic today, Medved, he seemed actually surprised to learn that I hadn't come directly from the Tora Bora with the latest instructions from the Emir. Let's be clear about something. Osama bin Laden has nothing to do with us. Osama bin Laden was invented, armed, financed, and sent to Afghanistan by the United States of America and Great Britain and Saudi Arabia and Egypt, and Turkey. We won't allow any rewriting of history about this. If you'll permit me to quote myself, on the night before the fall of Kabul, two bin Laden and the Mujahideen, so-called, the fathers of the Taliban, I said to Mrs. Thatcher, though I was the last man standing in the British Parliament saying this, that wasn't the last time that was to happen, I said to Mrs. Thatcher, in the British Parliament, you have opened the gates for the barbarians, and a long dark night will now descend upon the people of Afghanistan. And I never said a truer word. We have to tell the Medveds of the world, whether they want to hear it or not, over and over again, don't try and hang Osama bin Laden round our neck. He was your man, and he went to Afghanistan to do your dirty work, which is one of the many reasons why we say that the attack on Afghanistan after 9/11 was doubly unjust. There were no Afghans on those airplanes that struck the United States. No Afghan ever hurt any American. Most of the Afghans who have been slaughtered since 9/11 don't even know where the United States is. Never heard of Seattle, Washington. Don't know about Boeing and its plant and its anti-union practices. The poorest, most ragged people on the earth were bombarded by the most powerful and richest people on earth. And they did nothing wrong to the United States. Sure, the Taliban and bin Laden were living on their territory because we sent them there and helped them win the war that put them in power. And so, having inflicted these people on the Afghans, we then punished the Afghans for the fact that these people were in charge of them. Now, we are very clear about this. The act of mass murder that took place on 9/11 in New York, took place on 7/7 in London, took place earlier in the railway carriages in Madrid, were criminal acts of mass murder. It is a crime, it is a sin in any language, in any religion, to punish innocent people for the crimes of guilty people. It's a crime. It's a big crime. The difference between us and Bush is, we say it's a crime to kill innocent people for the crimes of guilty people, whether it's happening in Kabul or Baghdad or Fallujah or London or New York or Madrid or anywhere else in the world. That's the big difference between him and us. You see, when the wives of our President and Prime Minister, on the anniversary of 9/11, Mrs. Bush Jr., I'm going to come back to Mrs. Bush Sr. later on, and Mrs. Blair, they gave a radio broadcast, synchronized swimming in the grief of the anniversary of 9/11. They invited us in their joint broadcast never to forget those heartbreaking messages of love and farewell left by those poor American women on those airplanes on 9/11 from their mobile telephones, messages left on the answering machines of their loved ones. They asked us never to forget those messages, as if we could. But as I said at the time, just because Afghan women don't have mobile telephones and their loved ones don't have answering machines, it doesn't make their deaths delivered from the sky any less obscene than the deaths of those women on those aircrafts in the United States on 9/11. But you know, that may be a truth self-evident to you and me, but as I looked around the British Parliament, whom I was addressing with those words, I could see on the faces of those powerful men, mainly men, in the British Parliament, that wasn't a self-evident truth at all. We have to face this fact. In the world we have today, run by the people who run it today, the blood of some people is more valuable than the blood of others. Nobody can deny that. There are no minute silences for the dead women in Afghanistan. There are no fundraising concerts to look after the families of those whose breadwinners were killed in the bombardment of Afghanistan. They don't even know how many died in Afghanistan, let alone what their names were. There are no plaques with all their names on it to commemorate them. Very few people even gave them a second thought. They were just collateral damage in the bombardment by the richest, most powerful, upon the poorest and most ragged. Now, most people in the West are oblivious to the fact that this double standard about the value of different people's blood exists. But let me tell you, there are no Muslims in the world who are oblivious to it. Every Muslim in the world knows that an American life is worth more than an Afghan life. A British life is worth more than an Iraqi life. An Israeli life is worth more than a Palestinian life. They all know that. And it's because they know that that so many of them are boiling with rage, a subject to which I shall return again and again. Now, I got into trouble from some sections of the media in New York. Well, the New York Post, actually. It's not really... it's the sort of printed equivalent of Mr. Medved. Mr. Rupert Murdoch owns it. He's what I call a serial patriot. He was a patriotic Australian when he owned all the Australian papers. Then he moved to Britain, he became patriotically British. And now he's running Fox Television and the New York Post and all the rest. He's as patriotic as an American can possibly be. But beware, he's building up a lot of interests in China. So, if needs must, it may have to be a different sort of patriotism. So, I got into trouble in the New York Post for saying this, and I'll quote it directly because it's important to the rest of this story this evening. I said, "You may think that those aeroplanes that struck the Twin Towers on 9/11 came out of a clear blue sky. But I believe they emerged from a swamp of hatred and bitterness and enmity against us that exists out there and especially in the Muslim world. And that swamp is being endlessly refilled and replenished with every new injustice that we visit upon the people of the Muslim world." And for some reason, that proved exceptionable to the New York Post, who appeared to believe that these planes just really did come out of a clear blue sky, that there was no reason why this occurred. Now, to state that there is a reason why it occurred is not to say it was right. It's not to support something, to try and understand how it happened. Indeed, if you don't want it to happen again, you have an absolute duty to try and understand how it happened. But it's remarkable how many people, well, they say that there are none so blind as those who will not see. It's remarkable how many people, especially here in the United States, but also in some circles in Britain, have not yet grasped that dichotomy, which is very important to this story. It's because I don't want to see any more 9/11s. I don't want to see any more 7/7s. That I want to drain that swamp of hatred, of the bitterness, and of the enmity that led to these atrocities. I'm not suggesting we negotiate with Bin Laden. As I said that day, when the House of Commons was recalled 4 days after 9/11. I despise Osama bin Laden. The difference is, I've always despised Osama bin Laden. I despised him when you were giving him guns and money and support and telling him what he should be doing. It's because I want to negotiate not with bin Laden or bin Ladenism. I want to negotiate with those who haven't joined him yet. I want to negotiate with those who might join him tomorrow if we don't drain that swamp of the grievances which are feeding this phenomena of Islamist, fundamentalist, obscurantist terror. Now that's common sense to me. It is not Mr. Medved, not repeat, not me speaking up for bin Laden or bin Ladenism, quite the opposite, in fact. So they ask me, well, what would you do to drain that swamp? I say, well, there are many things, but there are three main things that we have to do, or would have had to do, if we were not going to follow a course of action which we did, which has created 10,000 new bin Ladens, made even more millions of people hate us even more bitterly than they already did. I said, the first thing we have to do, and this is the most important message I have for the United States of America. If you listen to nothing else I say, listen to this. The first reason, the flaw at the heart of the West's policy towards the East, the policy towards the Muslim world of countries like America and Britain, the flaw at the heart of that policy is the more than 50 years of injustice that has been visited upon the Palestinian people, paid for by American money and made possible by American political support. You know, every bullet in the back of a child in the Gaza Strip was paid for here by the United States taxpayer. Every rocket that's ever fired into a refugee camp is fired from an Apache helicopter given to General Sharon by the government of the United States of America and paid for by you. You may not know that. Maybe your people don't know that. There's not a single Muslim in the world who doesn't know that every crime committed by General Sharon is paid for by the United States of America. And when the Security Council convenes to condemn it, you can be sure it will be vetoed by the United States of America. Your people might not have noticed it. Every Muslim in the world has it engraved on their heart as the most grotesque injustice and unfairness and unbalanced policy anywhere in the world, followed by any government, is the unending, bottomless support your government gives to every crime committed by Sharon's Israel. And if you don't wake up and smell that particular coffee, I tell you, you will never be done with this great crisis that exists between the West and the East, which exists between your country and mine and the Muslim world, 1,500 million strong. Let me run that number past you again. 1,500 million Muslims in the world, of whom hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of millions hate us bitterly, of whom tens of millions are ready to support those who wish to hurt us in retaliation for our injustice, of whom probably hundreds of thousands are ready actually to hurt us, to trade their lives for many of ours. So, if there's no justice for the Palestinian people, there will be no peace in the Middle East. We must understand that. No justice, no peace. No justice, no peace. You see, this double standard is written more brazenly on this question than any other. Iraq was broken on the wheel of sanctions and then war. For what? To demonstrate that UN Security Council resolutions must be obeyed. To demonstrate the unacceptability of acquiring other people's territory by force. To demonstrate the unacceptability of acquiring weapons of mass destruction chemical, biological, and nuclear. But no country in the world has broken more United Nations Security Council resolutions than Israel. No country in the world has occupied other people's territory by force for longer than Israel. And we know, thanks to the brave Jew Mordechai Vanunu, that Israel sits on top of a mountain of weapons of mass destruction, including hundreds of nuclear weapons targeted at all the Arab capitals with the missile capability to deliver them and destroy any and all Arab capitals in an afternoon. So Iraq gets broken for these three reasons. Israel gets rewarded for these three reasons. Last week was the 23rd anniversary of the massacre of Sabra and Shatila refugee camps in Beirut. I remember them well. I used to live in them. That's not an anniversary that was much observed here in America. Not much observed in Britain. Most people, maybe even some in this hall, don't even know what I'm talking about, Sabra and Shatila massacre. But every Muslim in the world remembers the Sabra and Shatila massacre. Let me tell you, or remind you, what happened there. In 1982, the Palestinian fighters left Beirut on board ships under international guarantee that their families left in the refugee camps would be protected. That international guarantee was signed by the ambassador of the United States of America, and no sooner had the ships sailed out of harbor than these refugees, old men, women and children only, no young men left, were fallen upon like wolves. The Israeli forces and their Lebanese fascist allies poured like wolves into the refugee camps and massacred thousands of Palestinian refugees, defenseless, without arms, without men to protect them. And who was in charge? Who was in charge of that massacre? Who was literally standing at the gate of the camp? I mean literally. He's pictured standing at the gate of the camp while the massacre was going on. You're right, General Ariel Sharon. The same Ariel Sharon that Mr. Bush tells us is a man of peace. I mean, even Sharon doesn't consider himself to be a man of peace. But George Bush thinks he's a man of peace. And when Sharon turned up in New York last week for the UN, we were expected to treat him like a statesman with a red carpet. He wasn't treated like Hugo Chavez with his security men denied visas, coming to a country where the president's friend has just threatened to murder him. No. Sharon was brought here and we were asked to be grateful, grateful that he finally, 40 years late, evacuated a few settlements in a small part of the occupied territories. Even though the settlers who were moved from Gaza each got, every one of those settlers was given $250,000 compensation for leaving stolen land that they should never have been on. Who paid that money? You did. Your government paid that $250,000 to every one of those settlers who illegally occupied other people's land for nearly 40 years against international law. 7,000 settlers occupying one-third of the Gaza Strip, leaving two-thirds for the other 1.5 million Palestinian refugees living in indescribable conditions. 7,000 settlers using nearly 40% of the water of the Gaza Strip that 1.5 million Palestinians had to share the balance of the water resources. And we were asked to feel grateful that Sharon finally moved those 7,000 settlers out, even though he still controls the water, the air, the borders, and can re-enter the Gaza Strip at any minute. One more story about that double standard, because it's important to grasp this. A friend of mine's with me here, Ron Mackay. Nearly 30 years we've been together. We met in the Palestinian refugee camps in 1977. And then 4 years ago, we visited another refugee camp called Jenin. Now, Jenin is a unique Palestinian refugee camp. 1 square mile, 10,000 families, 50 years. A rancid, rat-infested set of hovels. It's unique because the refugees could climb up onto the roofs of the refugee camp and they could actually see the shining city of Haifa and their own houses. Because every one of those refugees comes from the Haifa they can see from the roofs of their refugee camp on which they have subsisted for 50 years. They can see their own houses, their own gardens, their own orange trees, their own fruit being picked by people who came from Brooklyn and Paris and London and all over the world, who claimed that God, the estate agent, promised this land to them. Can you imagine what it would be like to be in a refugee camp and be able to see your own house being lived in by someone else? But not content with that torture for half a century, 4 years ago, Sharon's army poured into that refugee camp, just like they did in Sabra and Shatila, and began massacring the Palestinian inhabitants. And Ron and I were there within 2 days of the fall of the camp. It was still smoldering. You could still smell the dead people who were still lying unburied underneath the crushed masonry. So horrific was this massacre that on a Saturday night, the Security Council gathered in New York and passed a resolution, this time not vetoed by the United States. So horrific was the massacre, demanding that Israel allow inspectors to go into the camp to check reports of mass destruction amongst the refugees. Sharon answered on the Sunday morning, there will be no United Nations inspectors entering Israel or entering the camp in Jenin. He told them to get stuffed. And guess what? That's exactly what they did. The United Nations Security Council, which on the Saturday night had augustly passed this demand, by Sunday night had packed their suitcases and gone home and said nothing more about it. Now, most people in the United States and the United Kingdom don't know or care much about that. But every Muslim in the world knows and cares about that. It's another of the reasons why the swamp gets deeper and deeper. And out of that swamp comes the mutation of terrorism that we saw on 9/11 and on other occasions. The second main reason why this swamp exists is our policy, your policy, of propping up every puppet president and corrupt king who rules the Muslim world almost without exception from one end to the other. You know, you have to laugh. They say they invaded Iraq so that they could have democracy. Next door to Iraq is a country called Saudi Arabia. It's one the Bush family knows well. Mr. Bush Sr. has made $10 million through the Carlyle Group from his dealings with the kleptocracy who rule Saudi Arabia. Mr. Bush Jr. made a bit too, before he became president, with investment in his fading and then failed companies by a Saudi citizen called Bin Laden, but we'll not go into that. You may have seen the death of the tyrant, King Fahd, a couple of months ago. All the Western leaders descended upon this prison state called Saudi Arabia. A state so reactionary that women are not allowed to drive motor cars. Women are not allowed to set foot on the street without being accompanied by a male relative. Where there is no democracy of any kind and never has been. Where you're not even allowed to elect the secretary of a fishing club in case the idea should become contagious. Why did they all descend on Saudi Arabia to mourn the passing of this tyrant, apart from their own personal business interests? Because the thief they were burying sent almost all of the money he stole here. He turned his country into a private bank and looted it systematically, spending the money in the casinos, in the bordellos, in the arms bazaars, and in the banks and stock exchanges of the West. Saudi Arabia has $6 trillion in the American banks and the American stock market, which means, of course, that they don't have it at all. Because if they ever dreamt of withdrawing their $6 trillion, it would have to be compensated and confiscated rather overnight, because it would occasion the collapse of the United States economy if $6 trillion were withdrawn. So in fact, the thief, Fahd, didn't just steal the money from his country. He actually gave it away, effectively, to the United States of America in exchange for the military, political, and diplomatic support to allow him to stay in power. And when the Western leaders arrived for the funeral, it wasn't just to bury the tyrant, it was to kiss the nose as a prelude to kissing somewhere else of the tyrant who replaced him, in the hope that they could continue business as usual with that tyrant. Now, I'm laboring that point for this reason. What do you think the people of Saudi Arabia think when they hear Bush and Blair talking about freedom and democracy and liberty, when they see all these Western leaders on their knees in front of the tyrants who rule them? What do you think they think in the Arab world about the idea of you wanting democracy in their region when you are in the pockets of such a tyrannical set of thieves? Or Egypt. Sometimes they tell us, well, one good thing came out of the invasion of Iraq. There was a free election for president in Egypt, they said a few weeks ago. Well, actually, President Mubarak himself told us it was the first free presidential election, he said. Well, given he's already served 4 terms, that was a clear statement that he had stolen the previous 24 years of political power in Egypt. But the amazing thing is, and this has been missed by almost all commentators, Hosni Mubarak got more votes in the free election last month than he got in the rigged election 6 years previously. I'm not making that up. He got 84.8% of the vote 6 years ago, and in the free election, he got 88.6% of the vote. That's really something, political popularity. I've been elected 5 times to the British Parliament, and I've been quite popular sometimes, but getting 88.6% of the vote is something people like me can only dream of. But that's what they got in Egypt. So I'm making the point to you, what do you think they think in Egypt? They don't know whether to laugh or cry when they hear Bush talking about democracy. Because they've just been landed with a grinning buffoon for president for the next 6 years, as a prelude to his son taking over with 88.6% of the vote, even though hardly anybody voted for him. So they don't know whether to laugh or cry. Or does the general, do you remember him? The general. Mr. Bush was interviewed just before the first presidential election. Do you remember? And he was asked the names of some of the world leaders that he would be dealing with if he got elected. And the interviewer said, who's the leader of Pakistan? And Bush looked a bit shy and he said, the general. And the interviewer said, I mean, can you be a bit more specific? Maybe a name. And Bush thought for a moment, or five, and shrugged and said, we just call him the general. I mean, don't act surprised. A man that thinks the people who live in Kosovo are called Kosovarians. People who live in Greece are called Grecians. Man who said that the problem with most American imports is that they come from overseas. Don't act surprised. The general in question was General Musharraf, who seized power in a military coup, was suspended from the British Commonwealth, put on an arms embargo list, described as a military dictator until Bush needed him. Then he remembered his name. Except by then he was no longer called the general. He was called the president, Mr. President. And his pockets were stuffed with money and his armory was stuffed with weapons. And when he got nuclear weapons, Mr. Bush didn't threaten to invade him or impose sanctions upon him. He rewarded him for obtaining nuclear weapons. So much for checking nuclear proliferation. So I could go on all night, but I'm being told I'm going on too long already. I could go on all night. I could give you example after example from Uzbekistan to Nigeria. I could go across the world and show you places where the United States is propping up and making possible the most brutal dictators rule over their people. And that is the second of the real principal reasons why this swamp of hatred has been endlessly deepened in the way that I have described. And of course, the third and most current reason why is the enormous crime that has been committed against the people of Iraq. I spent a lot of years trying to rouse the people of the West about the unbelievable disaster that was unfolding in Iraq, where 1 million Iraqis, most of them children, most of them dead before they ever got to know that they were Iraqis, because they were too young, but who died for no other reason than that they were Iraqis. There were only a few of us. Very fine American called Kathy Kelly, Voices in the Wilderness. I don't know if you know her. A fine American congressman, Democratic Party whip in the Congress, David Bonnier of Michigan, who described the policy of these sanctions as infanticide masquerading as politics. The late Pope John Paul II called it the slaughter of the innocents. For more than a decade, an Iraqi child died every 6 minutes of every day and every night as a result of that embargo. It's the biggest mass grave in Iraq, but it's the one mass grave you can be sure Fox TV will not be filming, will not be at the exhumation of its victims, for its victims were victims of us, men in suits, elegant barbarians, in the offices of the United Nations in New York, making decisions that caused the slaughter of 1 million children. Now again, most people in the West didn't want to know about that. They were only Iraqis, they were only Arabs, they were only Muslims. But no Muslim ever forgot it. And it's another of the major reasons why that swamp got ever deeper and these monsters germinating within it got ever more dangerous. Now, instead of draining the swamp, everything we've done has been to make it deeper. Instead of stopping the blank check for Ariel Sharon, we kept on writing them. Instead of stopping the propping up of the puppet presidents and the corrupt kings, we kept on doing it. And we compounded the massacre of 1 million Iraqis by sanctions, by the invasion and occupation of Iraq, which I started out speaking about. I won't insult your intelligence by going through it all again. Everybody, every sentient being in the world, actually, now knows this was a terrible mistake. Even the New York Times poll, I think 2 days ago, somebody referred to it, 52% of the people in the New York Times poll wanted to withdraw American forces from the Iraq war. Clear majority in both of our countries thinks it was a very bad mistake. In our country, even before we knew what we know now, there was a clear majority against doing it. Yet it was done. And everything that we said about the Iraq war turned out to be true. And everything Bush and Blair said turned out to be false. Except where it was a deliberate falsehood. They told us there were weapons of mass destruction. There were none. They told us there was a link between Iraq and 9/11. And there was none. They told us there was a connection between Iraq and Al-Qaeda, and there was none. But there is now. There's plenty of Al-Qaeda in Iraq now. And these idiots on the radio today, one of them phoned in and said, well, we're fighting them over there, so we don't have to fight them over here. But you're manufacturing thousands more of them over there. And eventually they will be over here. Exactly what happened in Afghanistan is what will happen as a result of Iraq. Thousands upon thousands of foreign fighters, they call them. Although I'm not sure how credible a description that is on the lips of an American general in Iraq. When they're finished in Iraq, they'll be heading our way, just like those who trained in Afghanistan eventually headed our way. But the biggest lie of all the lies that they told was the lie that the Iraqi people would welcome hundreds of thousands of foreign soldiers invading their country, seizing their territory, parking their tanks on every street corner, their soldiers kicking indoors, rampaging through their women's bedrooms, taking off their sons blindfolded, hands tied behind their backs, to places like Abu Ghraib prison, where they'd strip them naked, pile them on top of each other, force them to commit indecent acts against each other, menace them with savage dogs, attach fake electrodes to their genitals and pretend that they're about to electrocute them, and videotape it all for a laugh in the barracks afterwards. They thought the Iraqis would welcome this. What kind of a racist fantasy is this? That of all the people on the earth, Iraqis would welcome hundreds of thousands of foreigners invading their country and stealing their wealth, carving their country up like a shawarma and handing it out piece by piece to Halliburton and Bechtel and Kellogg and Brown and Root and all the other crooks that financially supported the re-election of George W. Bush. Why should the Iraqis be less than us? Well, it could never happen to you, but it almost happened to us in 1941 when we stood alone against fascism, which was at the Channel ports 21 miles from our country. If Hitler had crossed the Channel and occupied our country, every British person with any self-respect, whether they supported Churchill or not, would have fought the German invasion of our country with every last breath and with their teeth if necessary. And that's what the Iraqis are doing in the wake of the foreign invasion of their country. Now, I like to tell this story, and I'm coming to an end. I like to tell this story because it's very important for the decisions you're going to be asked to make in the next couple of months. People like me are asked to do it every day, but you will be increasingly as this crisis deepens in Iraq. And I'm going to tell you how deep it's going to get in just a few minutes. But I tell this story. I told it in Boston on my first night here. I spoke in a hall in Boston where the great leaders of the American freedom struggle spoke. The great struggle of the American people against colonialism. And I tell the story of my favorite British member of parliament, whose name was Charles James Fox. His statue is the first statue you find as you come into the building through St. Stephen's entrance. He was expelled from parliament twice. Once for supporting the American Revolution. The second time for supporting the French Revolution. He was a little harsh on the second occasion. He tabled a motion in the House of Commons congratulating the people of France upon their execution of the King and Queen and looking forward to the same fate befalling all the crowned heads of Europe. But he was expelled on the first occasion for his support for your country's freedom struggle. And I play this little game. Imagine if we could go back in time and meet Charles James Fox. And a conversation like this might take place. Are you sure this is a good idea? What if these people become free? What if they win and they become free? And their country ends up being run by a lot of bigoted fundamentalists like the Reverend Pat Robertson and George W. Bush and Dick Cheney and Donald Rumsfeld. And Fox would answer, "That's up to them. No one can choose the government of the United States of America except the people of the United States of America. And no one can choose the government of Iraq other than the people of Iraq." And you have to be clear about that question. I told you I'm of Irish background. When the Irish people rose at Easter time in 1916, striking one of the most decisive blows against the British Empire, seizing the General Post Office in O'Connell Street in Dublin, and proclaiming the Irish Republic, so-called progressives in London, the Fabians, the Liberals, the Christopher Hitchens of their day, declined to issue a certificate of support for these Irish rebels. These Irish rebels, they said, were priest-ridden, bog-trotting, Catholic fundamentalists, Gaelic, Celtic obscurantists who would take Ireland out of the empire, yes, but into the mists of a kind of Celtic brigadoon. But they made the mistake. You see, the only certificate of authenticity required was the one issued by the Irish people for the Irish freedom struggle. They don't require the certificate from anybody else. And so when you are told, as you will be, well, we can't leave Iraq, Because if we do, it'll be run by Muslims. Shock, horror. In an Arab Muslim country, it'll be run by Muslims. It's too late for all that. And by the way, the longer it takes, the more extreme will be the Iraqi government that will emerge at the end of it. You have to withdraw from Iraq. You will withdraw from Iraq sooner or later. It's better that it's sooner rather than later, before thousands upon thousands of more people are killed. Now, my very last point is this. I said I'd come back to Mrs. Bush. I can tell from the American media and from talking with people on this tour how horrified everybody is about the catastrophe that struck the American Gulf Coast and the aftermath of it. I just don't know if you fully grasp how it looks in the rest of the world. The Bush administration stands naked in front of the whole world, and it's not a pretty sight. We knew that these people were malevolent, but we didn't know they were also utterly incompetent. And these people who cannot even organize in the richest, most powerful country in the world. Actually, if you heard that radio broadcast today with Medved, the whole trouble started out by him introducing the show thus. Welcome to whatever the name of his station is, broadcasting from the greatest nation on the face of God's green earth. I said to him, isn't that a little vainglorious? Who awarded you that title? Did you award it to yourself? In which case, what is it worth? Did God award it? If so, when and where? He couldn't get me. He couldn't understand why that would be offensive to me. I said, well, I think my nation's quite good too, you know. So do the people of Norway and France and Germany and Italy and Greece and every nation in the world. None of us except you are greater than us, you know. That statement, analyze it. That statement that this is the greatest nation on the face of God's green earth means that everybody else in every other nation is less than you. And this is the problem, you see. The rest of the world believes that you think that. But I said to him, well, I've been looking at New Orleans. You don't look so great down on the streets of New Orleans. I must tell you that. I must tell you that. Now, Marie Antoinette, the French queen, before the French Revolution, was told that the people were revolting, for they had no bread. What do you mean they have no bread? She said, why don't they eat cake? Wasn't that what Barbara Bush was really saying down in that Astrodome in Texas? Wasn't she really saying these poor people have never had it so good that they should be grateful that they're in an Astrodome eating bread handouts? And the only problem with them, she said, was that too many of them seem to want to stay on in Texas after it's all over. This Bush family are the Bourbons of our age. You talk about national disasters. The Bush dynasty are the biggest national disaster that this country has ever faced.